Hello, this is Debbie Lewis from Awaken Your Leadership Power, and today I have Janet Crawford on the phone with me. Janet, you want to say hello to our listeners?
Hi, everyone.
And before I jump into a conversation with Janet, which we've got a wonderful topic to talk about, I'd like to give you a little bit of background on her. So Janet Crawford is the principal of Cascade and Stance and an advisor to T2 Venture Capital, combining insights from neuroscience, evolutionary biology, anthropology, and experimental psychology. She helps leaders build productive, innovative, and collaborative corporate cultures. With 2 decades of experience coaching and consulting for Fortune 500 companies, her client organizations span the who's who of Silicon Valley and beyond. Janet holds a master from Stanford University, a BA from UC Berkeley, and is the former adjunct faculty at the JFK University Graduate School of Psychology. And Janet, again, welcome to the Telesummit today.
Thanks so much.
And the first question I have for you is that, you know, you've been coaching leaders for, you know, getting close to 20 years, and you were a pioneer, or I should say you are a pioneer in incorporating neuroscience. What made you get interested in the neuroscience, and why has this approach been gaining so much popularity?
So I started using neuroscience in my practice in the late 1990s, and I used to joke that it was the easiest way to clear space around me at a cocktail party at that time, because it just sounded like this incredibly esoteric subject that only brainiacs would be interested in, and I would probably sit there holding forth on a bunch of brain parts that people didn't understand. If you fast forward to today, neuroscience is an incredibly popular subject matter. And the reason why is that there have been a number of advancements in neuroscience that have allowed us to study the emotional brain and the social brain in ways that give people incredible insight into why they behave the way they do and why groups behave the way they do. So the information that's coming out of neuroscience now has this kind of immediate applicability that maybe the information that we had 20 or 25 years ago didn't. So I originally got into the topic for 2 reasons. One was that I grew up in a scientific family. My father was a rocket scientist, and he
was literally a rocket scientist.
Literally a rocket scientist.
Wow.
You know, so when we were out socially, if somebody said, "Well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist," my father would say, "Well, that's great. I'm off the hook."
Love it.
And not only was he a rocket scientist, he was a fairly renowned rocket scientist. So he was the rocket scientist that other rocket scientists admired.
Nice.
So as such, I grew up in a really hyper-rational, hyper-logical, scientifically-minded family. And I was raised on a scientific research base in the middle of the Mojave Desert, so everybody around me fell into that same class.
Mm-hmm.
And I oftentimes felt like an outsider because I was observing the behavior of these groups, even as a small child, and saying, these people are saying that they're logical, but their behavior doesn't seem to be logical at all.
Right.
But yet, they seem to be under this kind of delusional spell that it is, in fact, logical. And I was also having these feelings of, well, there are things that I understand that I don't have necessarily the logic to explain, and when anything falls in that category, if I can't make an airtight argument for it, it's dismissed as not valid. So that was always a tension in myself growing up. And then I also was observing around me in my family and in others a variety of what we now know as neurological spectrum. We sometimes call them disorders, or sometimes we call them neural diversity now, because we're starting to understand that things like depression, actually the neurology that creates that has some upsides, but we simply don't necessarily see the upsides in our society. So I grew up around people who had depressive disorders, who had synesthesia, who had mild forms of autism, et cetera. And I wanted to understand how those things affected behavior and what it was that how those things manifested themselves in group interactions. So in the late or mid-1990s, I stumbled fortuitously across a number of different books and pieces of research in neuroscience. Because I am a scientist, I'm not a neuroscientist, but I am an environmental research scientist, and so I can understand scientific literature quite fluently, I immediately saw some of the crossovers from that research to understanding groups. And at the time, I was the manager of a large group of scientists and regulators, and so I was seeing that same behavior that I had seen as a child playing out in my adult life. So I think it's gotten the amount of stickiness now because that information about the emotional and social brain, has now gotten out to the larger population, and it allows us to understand these seemingly irrational behaviors from a logical and rational standpoint.
Yeah. That's wonderful. And so what is the biggest societal misconception about the brain and behavior?
I think the master misconception, the kind of misconception that drives a lot of the other misconceptions, is that we are individual, consciously motivated creatures.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm an individual person. I get up in the morning. I'm the captain of my destiny. I decide what I'm going to do. And if things don't work out, it pretty much falls on me. So that's the ethos of our culture, that people create their lives. And we do. And in fact, that's one of the human superpowers that we have, is that we can be volitional. But we're not primarily volitional. So 99% of what you do is decided in the background and never bubbles up into your consciousness.
Right.
So the environment that we're in, the social groups that we're part of, our individual histories, the instincts that we're born with as human beings, these things all clump together to form this kind of soup that drives most of our behavior. And it's invisible. It's in the unconscious world. So oftentimes we have this push-pull, and this comes up for leaders and it comes up for coaches a lot, where we know consciously that we should be doing something different. I should have gotten out of bed earlier this morning. I shouldn't have played that extra game of Sudoku. I should have had more protein with my breakfast. I should have not hit the send button when I saw that inflammatory remark on email. And yet we do all these things. And
yeah,
we do them even though we know in the moment that there's a better decision available.
Mm-hmm.
And this is that unconscious brain at play.
Yeah,
it's that 99% that's stronger than that 1% of volition. So that's the big concept, that if we get it, we start to have incredible power over our lives, because the influence on that 99% is where the power to change lies.
And so how, in your viewpoint, does that affect leaders and their organizations, especially for all, you know, if all of us are walking around in 99, you know, living in that unconscious 99% part of it, how does that play out?
So there's a lot of different manifestations of that. So I'll give you several, and just know that this is just a partial list because we only have a very brief period of time here. So one of the ways that that plays out is that health practices have a tremendous amount to do with how much volition we have. So we can actually strengthen that 1%. We can become more volitional. We can have more of that capacity available to us, or less, depending on how we're living our lives. So to make a concrete example here, lack of sleep, which is a pervasive problem in organizations.
Yeah.
And people have this belief that, well, I'd love to have more sleep, but that sleep is kind of for wimps. You can sleep when you die. And the reality is you will die a lot sooner if you don't sleep, and the hours that you are alive will be much less effective.
Yeah.
Because lack of sleep robs us of volition. We may be at our jobs, but we're at our jobs acting on autopilot without the parts of the brain, our creativity, our morality, our choicefulness around emotionally triggering events plummets when we have lack of sleep. And so as a leader, one of the things that I would want to do is to create an organization that supports people in living healthy lifestyles, because those healthy lifestyles will have a direct impact on people's availability to, or people's ability to be choiceful in their behavior and to be able to be innovative and creative in their responses. So that's one concrete way that tapping into that concept of we're not entirely volitional creatures plays out for leaders. Another way is that the environment has a tremendous amount of influence on our choices. And so as a leader, I want to think about, I want to educate myself as to how the environment influences behavior, and then intentionally create environments that just unconsciously drive people toward the behaviors that we want them to manifest. So, for example, a lot of Silicon Valley companies now are intentionally creating their architecture so that people from diverse places in the company will have to intersect in the course of their normal activities. People have a neural tendency to group with people who are just like them and with whom they have a lot of familiarity. So what that does is it drives this kind of siloed behavior. And you can tell people, oh, get out and meet people from different backgrounds, but the reality is that people won't do that. It's like eating that protein with breakfast. We know we should do it, but do we do it? So what you want to do is to create an environment that drives the behavior. If you're trying to lose weight, the color of the plates that you choose, the color of your kitchen, how large your plates are, what food is at the front of the refrigerator, et cetera, have a huge impact on what you choose to do. So why make it hard on yourself? Why force that 1% of the brain to try to make all your decisions for you? Why not set up the environment so that the 99% makes the right decisions? So that's how that concept plays out for leaders.
Okay, terrific. Yeah, and so what can we learn from, you know, neuroscience? You know, building emotional intelligence is one of the, you know, the big movements that are now underway in a lot of corporations. So, you know, how does neuroscience play with building emotional intelligence?
Well, one of the ways that this has played out for me personally, and then also for my coaching clients and my organizational culture clients, is that when we understand how our emotional patterns and our emotional personality, if you will, develops, it gives us a great deal of compassion for ourselves and compassion for others. And that might sound kind of airy-fairy, but it's actually quite important. Because when I have compassion for myself, when I can say, that's an emotional response that I'm not proud of, but I understand why I do it. I understand how difficult it is to shift it. And I understand it's probably going to take me some time and focus to get there. It means that I can approach that emotional problem that I have, or maybe an emotional problem that somebody else has, as something that's kind of a long-term project. And I can approach it with curiosity and equanimity and compassion and keep going. Not just kind of give in to the idea of I'm just broken or that person's just broken. So how emotional patterns develop is that we get most of our emotional responses from the world in the first 2 years of our life, and we acquire them before we have any conscious memory. So we just absorb them from imitating the adults that are around us. And in fact, those early emotional patterns get coded in the brain as essential to our survival. So they're really difficult to shift. So giving ourselves a leg up, being compassionate, saying I understand that it's hard to shift these things and that it's doable, but I have to use every trick that I have to do it, is a really important factor in developing emotional intelligence. Another place where understanding the brain is helpful is understanding the effect of threat on the brain. When the brain feels threatened, it sends you into these kind of automatic and extreme responses. So fight, flight, and freeze, or if the threat's not huge, it can just set us in down the course of automated responses as opposed to thoughtful responses. So we might respond in the way that we did as a child as opposed to being a thoughtful adult. So as a leader, I can think about how do I set up an environment that is safe for my, stimulating enough to keep people engaged, but safe so that we don't tip them over into that threatened part of the brain. And then as an individual, I can start to understand what my individual triggers are and learn the early warning signals that I'm starting to go down a non-resourceful pathway and pull myself back. So those are two concrete ways that we can apply neuroscience to emotional intelligence. And then the third one.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The third one that I'll add in there quickly is that we come preloaded with a whole host of social instincts, and this is just starting to be understood well in the neuroscience world. So when you get upset, when you've been excluded, you didn't have to learn that exclusion was bad. You're born with that as an instinct, because back on the African savanna, when you got excluded from the group, the chance that you would die was pretty high. So that is an instinct that comes from our early evolution. And that holds true also for assessments of fairness, assessments of how much uncertainty there is in the environment and how much control we have over our social context, how much status we have. There's a whole host of these social instincts. They're very powerful. And when we feel like those social instincts are not being cared for, it, again, triggers that threat response in the brain. So as a leader, we really want to set up our environment so that we're not triggering that sense of exclusion or the sense that people are getting treated unfairly or that they're not getting adequate information. Because we can't think our way out of those. A lot of people will say, oh, well, people just need to learn how to buck up, you know, suck it up and get over,
right.
it. It's a phrase that I hear. But the fact is, as good as that sounds, it's a neurological impossibility.
And I think that also goes back to the point about compassion, right? It's like you got to be compassionate with people. And as you were describing that, you know, from a leader standpoint, I was thinking of, you know, holding that space for people. As you pointed out, realizing that, you know, we all have these patterns in us. And like you said, getting familiar with what yours are gives you a lot of compassion in the fact that others are still growing in their place. And I think a great leader is somebody who can hold that space for people that, you know, as an organization, you move forward, but allows you the opportunities to be able to, you know, work through your stuff in a very healthy environment.
Absolutely. It all kind of comes back to this expression, go slow to go fast. Because a lot of these things seem like they're annoying extras. And I'd like to flip that on their head, its head, and say, these are the core, this is the ground, this is the fertile soil from which you can build a highly functional and efficient organization. So if you don't attend to them, the other downstream stuff becomes so much more difficult. So actually taking the time to hold that space and to create those environments that are safe and stimulating actually speeds things up in the long run.
So another question for you in regards to, back again on learning, you know, things that we can learn from neuroscience, because it's such a fascinating topic, is, you know, how can you learn to be able to, like, manage your focus and your energy? Because I see that as a, to me, that's like a primary thing, especially your focus, you can have that clarity on things.
Yeah. So many, many ways. So I'll mention a few. One is back to these health practices. Your ability to focus plummets when you haven't had good sleep, when you haven't eaten recently, or when you've had too much sugar and processed food versus having just some good healthy food at a regular interval throughout the day, et cetera. So all of those health practices really make a difference in your ability to focus. Another thing that makes a difference is that we are not designed to take in the amount of information and to have the amount of bombardment of information that's present in our current environment. So if you think think back to the savannah, your day was pretty similar from one day to the next. There wasn't a constant flow of newness and distraction there. So our brain really is designed for a limited amount of that, and it gets hijacked by the amount of distraction that's in our lives today. So you have to not try to use your conscious volition to think your way out of the distraction. Just get rid of it. So we are designed to pay attention to social conversations. So when we see that counter on our email counting up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the brain goes, oh my gosh, I'm not doing what I need to do, which is to complete the social interaction. And so you feel compelled to go check it over and over again. And then that becomes a neural habit. It becomes a neural pathway that you just instinctively go back to it and go back to it. But what we know about the brain is that when you interrupt your thought process, it's kind of the analogy that I use, is it's like powering your computer down and then powering it back up. So each time you switch back and forth between a topic, you're doing that. And there's a huge amount of efficiency loss in those gaps. And this has been studied pretty thoroughly, that people that focus on one thing, get rid of the distractions, and then move on to the next thing, and don't attempt to multitask, in fact, are a lot more efficient than those who think they're covering 5 or 6 topics at the same time. So shut out the distractions, decide what you're going to do, and focus on that one thing.
You know, one of the things that I say to people is that there's no such thing as multitasking. It's all multi-switching, because you're right. Your brain has to reorientate. And the tip I'll give to people that I did a long time ago is those little pop-ups that come up, especially if you use Outlook in the work environment, get rid of it.
Turn them off.
Like that's the gopher hole, man. You see a little pop-up come, and people just have the urge to dive into it.
And so, here's the thing. We can't resist that urge. So this is one of those places where we like to think, oh, I'll just ignore it. But your brain is not designed to ignore it. So you might look at it and then decide not to go there, but you actually have to use up some of that 1% to do it. Since you only have 1%, don't waste it on stuff like that.
Right.
Save it for the places where you really need it, where it really matters. So our brains are designed to follow bright, shining objects. Our brains are designed to follow anything that bounces or flashes or beeps. And our environment is full of those things. So to the extent that you can get rid of them, get rid of them. The last place that I will mention around focus is that we're not designed to keep track of multiple to-do items in our head. Because, again, go back to the savanna. You weren't carrying these long lists of novel things that you have to accomplish that day.
It was pretty much survival.
Right. So you've learned how to hunt. You've learned how to gather. You've learned your role in society by the time you're 13 or 14 years old, and then it's just slight iterations on that for the rest of your life. So there's usually only a few things that you have to remember. So the brain really doesn't hold more than about 5 or 6, at max 7 things at a time. And then everything else is kind of falling off the edge of the cliff. So set up systems where you capture things external to your brain. Write everything down that you need to do and keep it in one place. There's more to it than that, but that's just the starting point. It's like, don't rely on your brain to remember things. You're not getting Alzheimer's, you're human.
Yes, I can agree with that one.
And that applies, by the way, to PowerPoint, too, which is one of the biggest crimes against corporate humanity, I think, that's out there right now, is that people think that just because I can put it on a PowerPoint, I've communicated it. But the reality is that we're throwing people into these situations where they sit, and literally I've coached people where I've been shadowing them. I've been in a meeting for 3 hours that have been just one update after another, and each update has 30 PowerPoints that are covered with text. And people think because they stood up there and they talked about each one of these slides that people have actually taken the information in. And the fact of the matter is that they've taken in a tiny slice of it. And mostly they're just occupying a chair. And then people will argue, but it's all really important. And I'm like, well, if it's all really important, why don't you choose the pieces that are most important? Because otherwise they're not going to remember anything.
So a last question for you on the neuroscience is, how does it play with creating innovative cultures?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite areas because I live in Silicon Valley and innovation is the buzzword of the culture here. What drives innovation at its core is diversity. And I don't just mean diversity in the standard ways that we think about diversity, gender diversity, race diversity, but all of its broad components, people who think differently from you, people who are from a different socioeconomic standpoint, people who are in a different job role, different ages, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the soup that creates rich innovation, because innovation is really about the intersection of new ideas. And people have a tendency to learn a particular way of being in the world and then find other people who are like that, because those are the easiest people to get along with. And our brain is actually set up for that. We're set up to seek people who are like us because those are the safest people out there. We can predict them. There's not a lot of conflict with them. So the brain will actually drive you to seek those people out. But those kinds of groups are actually the least innovative out there. So there's this kind of neural paradox that exists in innovation, that we want to go for the people that are easy to get along with, but in fact those groups that are hardest to get along with are the richest for innovation. So as a leader, I really want to keep this in mind and know that not only do I want to create these diverse groups, but that I'm going to have to pay a lot of attention to creating a healthy group environment, a lot more attention than I would have to pay if it were a homogeneous group. So one of the things that we see in diversity conversations is there's a kind of revolving door. We say we want diversity, and then we bring the black person in or the woman in or the fill-in-the-blank diversity person into the mix. And we say, oh, gosh, we hired the wrong person because things got more difficult. Things got more contentious when they came in. So we're going to get rid of that person and find a new diversity person to bring in. And one of two things happens. We find somebody, we find that black woman who acts exactly like white men, and we think, great, we have diversity now. But we don't. We just have a white male that looks different from the standpoint of diversity. Or and we bring in that person who is really diverse and brings their opinions to the table, and people think, wow, that person is harder to work with than these other people. I prefer my former group. And we really have to learn that we have to intentionally create the conditions for diversity to thrive. And when we do that, the level of innovation that's accessible to us goes up astronomically.
It is, and I think as a leader, it just like you pointed out, it just takes time, and you have to cultivate it. So those voices, you know, that you're bringing in the circle are heard by all, you know, and so you need to nurture that environment for people until it becomes more, you know, until they get into their groove, if you will.
Absolutely. One of the biggest topics in the news right now is unconscious bias, and this is an area that I've done quite a bit of work. Something that we all need to work on being humble about is that this is not something that's just a phenomenon that exists outside of us. All of us have unconscious bias, and bias is actually, from a survival standpoint, a good thing. The brain learns from an early age what it should do or not do based on what it sees in the environment. But there's also some places where the brain leads us astray. So I remember giving a keynote at Intel, and I was invited to be at the leadership table the night before. And half the people at the table were from Asia, half them were from the United States. And partway through dinner, I realized that I was only talking to the people that were from the United States. Now, and the first thought I had was, well, the people from Asia seem a little bit standoffish. And then I had to kind of sit back and laugh at myself. Instead of flagellating myself for being so racist or biased, I can have compassion and say, oh, isn't that interesting? That's just the brain's natural neural tendencies playing out. And now that I have recognized that in the conscious mind, that 1% has said, oh, the 99% is causing me to do something that's an error, I can then correct for it in the conscious world. So those are the sorts of things that are really important when you're creating a diverse environment, is to have everybody understand that their brain is going to kind of try to push you in the wrong direction, and then to creatively and with humor institute practices that push us in the other direction.
Right, and I think the point you made is just so spot on, is have compassion for yourself, because we're human. And like you said, it's the natural part of us, which just wants to, the 99% part of us just wants to blend in with the folks that have that same look and feel about us.
Right. So one of my favorite things to say about this, which I think for a lot of people drives home the point, is we're not to blame, but we are responsible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So, Janet, I see our time is starting to run at the end here, and I know that you've got an offering for our listeners. Do you want to share it with them?
Yes. So for the first 5 people who respond to me by signing up on my mailing list, which is www.cascadence.com/contact. Cascadence is spelled C-A-S-C-A-D-A-N-C-E. For the first 5 people that sign up, I will offer a 30-minute private Q&A on the brain and your business, so that if you want to explore some of these concepts further, you'll have that opportunity.
And Janet, that's wonderful. And for our listeners, as always, there'll be an email be delivered to you right after this interview has concluded, and it will also have the information so you can sign up for that 30-minute private session with Janet. So, Janet, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
And do you have any last thoughts for our listeners?
Gosh. Yes. And this is going to go in a little bit of a different direction, which is that writing on the brain and referencing the brain in popular literature has become really commonplace. So my last thoughts for listeners is, as you're reading about the brain and references to the brain, do so with a critical eye, because there's also a lot of misinformation coming now from people who have only kind of partial understanding of the research. So ask yourself the question, is this person a scientist? Do they get their information directly from research? Where did this person get their information and their qualification to speak to the topic? Because that'll go a long way in ensuring that the information that you're getting is accurate and not just pop psychology.
Terrific. Well, Janet, thank you. And thank you to our listeners for being with Janet and I today on Awaken Your Leadership Power Telesummit. This is Debbie Lewis. Looking forward to talking with you tomorrow. Bye-bye.